Hello everybody and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast, a systems foresight series from Shoshin Works. The most transformative leaders don't build institutional empires. They build trust-based networks. And today we are exploring four counterintuitive principles: mission before organization, trust and not control, humility, not brand, and constellations, not stars. I'm your host. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata Desai Advisors, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Jane Weiss-Killern, who's a senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Her network leadership research has been downloaded over 31,000 times. She's a true thought leader in the field. Jane, first of all, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the podcast. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really thrilled to be here as well.
I gave the audience just a one-line introduction of you, but why don't you tell us a little bit more about your professional journey and how you came to your current position, to your current passion?
Sure, thank you. So my background is as an academic. My heart has always been in the world of practice. And of course, there are many academics that meld the two, but I think I have very deliberately kept impact in the field of social impact work and philanthropy and nonprofits at the center of every career decision I have made. And that has led me to where I am now. So I started at London Business School in organizational behavior. That was what my doctoral degree was in. I had studied at Stanford at the Graduate School of Business, and then was very fortunate to be invited to join the faculty at Harvard Business School in their social enterprise group. And that to me seemed like a dream job because I could focus fully on social impact work. And since then, I have left the tenure track. I decided not to go up for promotion and came back to California, where my home is, my family, and I grew up. I then joined the faculty of Stanford and Berkeley as clinical faculty, teaching as a lecturer, adjunct, associate. I've had pretty much every faculty title under the sun, moving further and further down the academic totem pole, but it has really led me to the most rewarding work I could ever have dreamt of doing. And that is work that supports practitioners in the field to do their best work, to collaborate effectively and make their limited resources go further, go faster in the impact that they can have. And it really is a joy to be able to do this work in helping other people build communities in service of a greater good.
And I think you're a great example of some of the best and most impactful and useful academic work, because as you said, it's work that helps practitioners, helps all of us, helps the economy. And I see the interesting contrast, because I grew up as an economist, and in economics, there is always a big debate, especially fierce now, on how much of economics is instead completely useless because it ends up being too abstract and too far removed from what is actually happening in the economy. But you have given us a great overview of your professional journey in academia, and you spent many years researching network leadership. When you started, you were told to find something from the private sector, apply to nonprofits, but you, unsurprisingly, took a different route. You decided to study the underdogs, the leaders who work alongside their peers and as equals rather than seeking dominance. So tell us a little bit about this. Why did you go down that route? And why do you think that this kind of mindset is especially powerful, and especially today, I would say?
Yes, thank you for that question. I love that. The main thing is, first of all, I never set out to be swimming upstream or an outlier or trying to be different. I really was.
You just can't help it. You just can't help it.
I think at a young age, I decided early on, I needed to do something that made a difference to me and to other people. And I'll share a personal story around that. When I started college, within the first few weeks of starting, my best friend was killed by a drunk driver after she had visited me and some of our friends at Berkeley. And We had just recently graduated. She was supposed to go to University of California, San Diego. So her school hadn't started yet. So she came to visit us. And I think at 18 years old, just starting out in the world, my first time away from home and having such an impactful event happen where I just could not believe a life could be snuffed out like that, that made me realize I had to do something that mattered. And no matter what I did, I had to have my heart in it because life was short and it could end anytime. And so it really did drive me to doing something that I cared about, and I couldn't do anything but that. And so I happened to study business as an undergraduate, and my goal was to open a preschool because I love children. I actually have 4 children of my own, and I was going to learn how to run a business so I could open a preschool. And over time, though, I didn't love all of the things we were studying in business. I didn't love finance or accounting or all of the things a lot of my peers were aspiring to be in big 6 accounting firms or go into consulting. And that just wasn't that exciting to me. But I did have some faculty mentors who were teaching business ethics or introduced some concepts around business ethics and corporate social responsibility. And that was late or mid-90s, where this was kind of a new thing, where Toms of Maine and The Body Shop, these types of companies that had social good baked into them, were relatively rare. And so I was very fortunate to have been inspired by that as a possibility. I realized maybe I can work in the social impact field somehow and teach, because I did love the idea of teaching, and then also do research that could be helpful to people. And so that was what I decided when I was applying to graduate school. I knew very clearly that was what I needed or wanted to do. And I didn't care. I was very fortunate. I actually didn't care that much whether I got tenure or not. I just wanted to focus on that and then have those ideas get out in the world and be adopted by other leaders so it could make a bigger difference. So I'm very fortunate to have the chance to have that as my North Star throughout my career. And that's how I found this topic around networks. I happened to study network theory as an academic in organizational behavior, but that was very data centric. It was getting a big data set from the Small Business Administration. I studied minority and women focused venture capital funds that were run through the Small Business Administration. There was a early seed program through SBA to foster the growth of the private equity industry in the U.S. to create jobs and innovation. And it actually was the precursor to the private equity industry in the U.S. And they also had this side program that focused on minority and women focused private equity funds. So that was my research in networks. And I was looking at the networks of those organizations and how that impacted their trajectories. So I had that in the background of network theory, but I studied in an entirely different way. And then when I got to Harvard, I was struggling to figure out, what can I do that's interesting and exciting to people? And this was early 2000s. There was a lot of interest in innovation, growth, scale, because, of course, we were just on the heels of the first dot-com boom, and a lot of new wealth was pouring into philanthropy, and social entrepreneurship was the new thing. And much of the emphasis and focus in our school, in our department, was, how do we start new enterprises? How do we grow them to scale? How do we do brand management? How do we structure them? How do we grow them to scale? And I think it was quite interesting. I had a lot of opportunities to listen and learn from a lot of smart people coming through our institution. And we had executives in our executive education program who were leading big nonprofit organizations, the corporate type nonprofits like Habitat for Humanity, the Boys and Girls Club, United Ways, these types of big nonprofit organizations, and they were struggling. They had big budgets, big brand names, great infrastructure, and yet they said, we're still not meeting our mission impact. We can't get our headquarters and field to get along with each other. Our field offices aren't learning from each other. There's a lot of internal politicking. That was on the big type of nonprofit side. On the startup side, virtually all of my MBA students in my social entrepreneurship elective wanted to start a new nonprofit. That was one of their interests. And of course, coming from a place like Harvard Business School, you're kind of conditioned to think about You're going to be the leader. You're going to be the founder. You have the best ideas. And of course, there are a lot of brilliant, smart people, but I've always realized that there is intelligence and there are smart people in every corner of the world. And you don't need an elite advanced degree to be smart. Some of the smartest, most inspiring people I have met do not have elite or even college degrees. And I think that sense of humility helped me understand that. And maybe personally, I never felt like I was the smartest. So I didn't ever pretend to be. And it was easier to just listen and observe and see what other people were doing. And I was writing cases for my social entrepreneurship course. And I came across a few examples of leaders who were working in this way that they weren't focused entirely on how do I get more in my budget? How do I grow my organizational infrastructure? How do I grow my power base in order to make social change? It was instead a complete contrast was how do I find trusted partners? How do I deepen those relationships? How do I build an ecosystem of like-minded peers with whom I can work with as equals to move the ball forward together so we can get that shared impact and yet leverage on resources, reduce redundancies, get sustainable and scalable impact. And I thought that was really beautiful and amazing. And I just started looking for more and more examples of that. And I got to have a reputation of somebody who was looking at that phenomenon. And so I would get referred, I would get cases referred to me by colleagues, or sometimes somebody might see something I had presented in a seminar or it was published. And then I actually had a leader who had been working that way his entire career. He was working at Habitat for Humanity. He's still a good friend of mine now, David Haskell. He had been Habitat for Humanity's regional director for the Middle East and North Africa. And he called me up out of the blue and said, I read about a seminar you presented on this network leadership, and I have a great example for you. And he and I became fast friends because here was somebody who had worked and lived and breathed this way of leading with his colleagues, particularly with his national director in Egypt, Yusri Makar, who had done this work in Habitat Egypt and transformed their housing program into one of the fastest growing, highest return on investment and scalable and sustainable programs out of all of Habitat's nearly 100 country programs. And they did it by working in this networked way. And so it was really serendipitous that I was struggling to find what I wanted to focus on research. And this was a perfect case, even though I had several other cases before that. But this helped hit home that this is something that's different and powerful, because you have almost a perfect controlled experiment of what typically happened in the traditional Habitat model of they own the entire value chain. They have a great program. They would manage and run the program, but oftentimes it was incremental gains. And here in Habitat Egypt, they said, what's already happening on the ground in communities? What indigenous partners can we help develop a housing program? How can we build local capacity in the field and give away our proprietary expertise and invest seed capital to support that growth? How can we support people to do what they already want to do and let go and trust? And they got such phenomenal results. So I wrote about Habitat Egypt, and then other cases came along, Energy Foundation and many others. And then it just became very clear to me that this was something worth studying, even though in the beginning, many others around me and even myself, I doubted. It's kind of very intuitive. At the same time, it's counterintuitive, because so many of our systems and our institutions and indeed our sectors drive against this type of behavior. So it's very counterintuitive in that light. But from a logical perspective, if you're thinking about how do I maximize impact in the world? How do I get to large scale social change with limited resources? Well, of course you need to work with others. Of course you need to build strong, robust, resilient relationships, not just short, arm's length transactional relationships. So it was these types of cases that gave me more and more confidence, and to meet senior executives who understood this very deeply and lived it out in their own work. That was really what gave me the confidence to pursue this and then basically make a career of it myself.
It's a very inspiring story of how you started and how you've developed and articulated this passion. And something you said about humility actually reminded me of a great quote by Richard Feynman, who said, "I'm smart enough to know I'm dumb." And this was Richard Feynman, right? So realizing that even though you truly are smart, as you certainly are, you need the humility to realize that you don't know everything and that people around you have insights. And you've also mentioned several times the word trust, which is the focus of one of your principles, which is trust, not control, which is perhaps the most provocative of your four principles. So tell us, trust, not control. What does it mean and how do you actually deploy it in an organization, especially in cases where you might be working in high stakes environments, right? As is the case for nonprofits trying to make the world a better place, but also industrial areas like defense or healthcare or financial systems.
Yes.
Trust, not control. What is it and how does it work?
Yes. And I'll admit, first of all, the principles that I laid out in my framework, I deliberately tried to be provocative about them, to say mission, not organization, trust, not control, but they really aren't mutually exclusive. That in fact, it's okay to have formal structures and systems, but there's also an added benefit to adding on these other elements around network leadership. So trust is that key element that I think is so powerful, but often underappreciated and underutilized in our professional lives. We use it quite readily in our personal lives with our loved ones, with our friends. We don't have contracts with our spouses, our life partners, our children, our family members, as far as what you will and will not do and what the consequences are going to be if you do not follow through. But in our professional lives, we almost think of humans in a less emotional way, that we think, well, it's all got to be carrots and sticks, the incentives, the structures, and that emotional piece doesn't matter. But in fact, when you add on trust into whatever you are doing, you get a deeper connection, commitment, resilience, robustness to what it is that you're doing. Because I have colleagues that I've had the chance to work with now where we've become very good friends, and I would go to the ends of the earth for them, and we trust each other. And I know that they would never seek to exploit something that we were doing together for their own advantage and vice versa. And it's not because of a contract. It's because we value that relationship and we share values and know that that's something worth preserving. So that trust, in my opinion, it truly is one of the most powerful governance tools we have in the world. And again, it's not to say you can't have an MOU or a formal contract, but if you spend time and energy first to find the right partners, do the due diligence up front. It's not just a matter of who looks good on paper and they seem to meet all the criteria. They're powerful enough, high status enough, they command enough resources. Yes, they would be a good partner. But rather, who has a good reputation for playing well with others in the sandbox? Who has a good reputation for being a high integrity, trustworthy person that follows through and really works with the larger cause in mind rather than their own potential self-interest? And that is something that speaks volumes. And when you found those types of people and you ally yourself with them and keep investing in the same way, the flywheel gets going and it just keeps going, and you want to keep working with them and you start getting the fruits of that collaboration, and then success breeds success. And you don't have to force it. You don't have to make people work in this way. We're drawn to people that we trust. We want to continue working with them. So there's this beauty that once you've built that relationship and that relational foundation with your peers and partners, then you can overcome so many challenges. And we all know any type of collaboration, whether within your organization or department or with partners external to your organization or even across sector, you will face challenges in collaboration. Undoubtedly.
And in fact, Jane, sorry to interrupt, but it just strikes me. Would you say that this reliance on trust is especially powerful in situations, in environments which are experiencing fast change and require greater flexibility, right? It just strikes me that control, if it's based on MOUs, if it's based on rules and agreements, those are by definition rigid.
Yes.
Whereas when you need more flexibility, perhaps the ability to rely on trust is a very powerful.
Yes, without a doubt. And thank you for adding that, because absolutely, it is true that when you can't predict everything that's going to happen or potential contingencies, you need that flexibility, and trust and a robust relationship will grease the wheels of whatever it is that you're doing, especially because we work in a world of complexity where there's information and circumstances are always changing. And therefore, you need that additional layer built into whatever it is that you're doing so that you can respond and adapt quickly.
You actually added another element that I want to underline, because I think it is very important, the issue of information, because we live in a world, in an economic environment, in a society that is not just more fast changing, and therefore it requires adaptability, but it's also more complex, so that it requires the intersection of expertise, but none of us can know everything. So to operate efficiently, I need to rely on your expertise, and I can only do that if I trust you, because you know something that I cannot know.
Exactly. And even in the older world, where maybe information was not as readily available, the reality is none of us ever could do all of these things on our own. That traditional mindset of, oh, if you came from an elite or strong educational background and you were in this stable environment, relatively stable environment, then you would be best equipped to make these decisions. But the world we live in has always been exceedingly complex, and there have rarely been simple black and white answers. And so the more that you are open and willing to learn and adapt and trust other people to make your decisions in the most well-informed way possible, the better off you are. But yes, the world we are in today demands that, perhaps even more so than it was in the past.
Talk to us a bit about one of your other pillars. Now, you've emphasized it's not a full black and white. It's not really completely either or, but it does, the way you frame these principles does highlight that the two things can go together, but there is a tension. There is a trade-off. And the other one is mission before organization. So talk about it. What do you mean by mission before organization, and what does it imply for organizations?
Yes. And my work has focused almost exclusively in the social impact space, in the nonprofit world, philanthropy, social entrepreneurship, and social purpose organizations. And of course, that overlaps with a lot of government and private sector as well, because virtually all organizations that humans have gotten involved in have been to improve the human condition in one way or the other. So at the same time, for many nonprofit organizations, there is often a focus on building your budget, fundraising, building your organizational infrastructure, and delivering on your mission with your organization as the primary vehicle for change. But the reality is, no matter what, under even the best of circumstances, the biggest foundation, the biggest nonprofit, the leading organization in their field is still just a drop in the bucket relative to the scale of the problem that these organizations are trying to address, whether it's poverty or economic development or education or animal rights, or environment, conservation, climate change. All of those things are so enormous that a single organization, a single sector is never going to be able to adequately address that. And of course, we all know that. But then our systems are designed in such a way that it's every tub on their own bottom, and every organization is just struggling, pushing this boulder uphill, like the Greek story of Sisyphus, who's pushing this boulder uphill for eternity, and it always rolls back onto him. And that's how organizations have often been leading or acting. And the shift from mission, excuse me, from organization to mission first is that oftentimes short-term decisions to advance just the organization don't necessarily advance the mission. So I'll give you a few examples. Again, most nonprofits are forced to focus on fundraising because their sustainability depends upon it. But in the social impact space, you have the luxury in some ways to say, if I'm successful, my best outcome is I'm so successful that nobody needs me anymore, that my nonprofit can close its doors and the world has changed, or there are other entities, organizations, institutions that are addressing the problem that I was trying to address, but at a scale better or an effectiveness level better than I could, and I'm not needed. So it's great if somebody steals your ideas and starts doing it and spreading whatever program or service you have to serve people effectively. Or it's great if somebody else can attract even more resources and your organization doesn't need to be there. So because the mandate is different in the social impact space, as opposed to in the private sector where you need to generate and create shareholder wealth, there's an even bigger opportunity in the social impact space to let go and allow mission-focused mission-focused activities to really take hold. And so I'll give you an example. I've seen network organizations fundraise on behalf of a peer or even a former competitor because their peer or competitor was better able to deliver a particular program or service. I've seen them give away their proprietary expertise or offer free technical assistance to their peers and former competitors because they knew that they could never grow to scale sufficiently to meet the needs in the community. So a better and highly leveraged way of doing that was to say, let's build capacity in the field, even if it doesn't operate under my own umbrella. And that will help spread my mission impact without me having to do all the work. Or organizations who say, actually, there are many examples of organizations that do seemingly altruistic things, but it really is in service of the mission impact as opposed to advancing their own organizational institution on its own.
These are beautiful examples, and they trigger a couple of reflections, which I think apply also to the world of for-profit companies. One is probably a profound lesson for organizations of all kinds, which is the behavior of the individual, right? Because even if you think of a for-profit company and you think of the mission simply as generating shareholder value, as an employee, as an executive, I can interpret that as pursuing my own power within the organization, or as truly trying to figure out what is best for the organization, which at times can require me to be more generous, to share more information, to take a step back, to take somebody else, take the lead on a project because they are better qualified. And in the end, it's going to be, if it's recognized and incentivized within the organization, it's going to be to everybody's benefit, but it is putting mission before organization. The other thing that comes to mind, and that I'd love to see hear your reaction to this, is the more negative examples where sometimes we have for-profit companies that end up behaving in a way that is, I would say, economically unsustainable because they put organizations before mission. So if a company is building a product, but because the mission in theory should be, yes, generating shareholder values, but by creating good products for the customers. If the organization then says, well, I just want the customer to buy more products, and therefore I will create engineered obsolescence into my products so that they break and customer is forced to come back, that is organization-oriented, not mission-oriented. It's understandable, but in the end, it's also likely to backfire. What do you think?
I absolutely agree with you. And I think we as consumers all know that when you've had a bad experience with a product versus a good quality product that lasts for years and years and years, your loyalty to that company and that company's products are so much greater that there is the long-term benefit. And of course, most companies want not just a one-time consumer, but a loyal consumer. That is a trap that maybe if you only focused on short-term incentives and what the benefits are for the immediate term, then you would go that route. But I can absolutely see the parallels in the private sector. And again, I think one of the challenges to all of what we're talking about, because it does seem so logical and makes sense that of course people should work this way. But so often the structures and the incentives in our systems, whether in the nonprofit or the private sector, actually are not well aligned to promoting this type of behavior and this type of leadership. And I find it interesting sometimes people who are not that familiar with the nonprofit sector wonder or are surprised that this isn't already the way people work, that they're surprised that in the nonprofit sector, it is so highly competitive. There is so much siloed work happening and people are kind of dog eat dog working against each other because it is such fierce competition. And that's something I hope to change. That's actually why I do the work that I do, to promote and shine a light on these great examples of leaders and their networks that have really led the way and gotten to the type of impact that so many organizations aspire to, but can never reach by working in this counterintuitive way. But I hope that more and more examples will get out in the world, not just from me, but from the more even just having this conversation, highlighting this, that shines a light on a different path that actually happens to be a more human-oriented way of working that's more fun and more joyful, that you are part of something bigger, that you're working in community, that you have relationships that you value and people that you trust that are surrounding you in your work, that it sounds somewhat utopian, but it is actually possible to work in that way with people. And we can layer it onto our existing systems and get to more resilient and robust and humane ways of engaging with each other in the world.
I think it's an excellent point. It's another example where it's not either or. It's not a utopian or Pollyannish view of how organizations should be structured. What you're saying is that on top of the regular, the standard incentive systems, creating a situation where people love working with each other and work well with each other is actually something that boosts creativity and productivity. So to me, it makes perfect sense. Gina, I said earlier on that your trust, not control principle was the most provocative, but now I'm wondering if the next one is actually even more provocative, especially in today's world, which is humility, not brand. Now, brand in today's world seems to be all important. So saying humility, not brand, is really phenomenally provocative. What do you mean?
Yes. And I should say that I use the term humility in a very broad way. So it's not to say that you never take credit for your good work or you never self-promote, but rather you go into situations, whether it's a meeting with one person or into a conference, that you go in to a meeting and interactions with an openness, a curiosity, a willingness to listen and learn and engage with people, no matter who you are, whether you're the CEO or you're the chief operating officer or the most well-funded organization, the most high-status organization, that you go in with this eagerness to be open to others. So it comes from everything when you're thinking about designing a program or a service, that you don't have all the answers, that you know that you need other people. You need beneficiaries and community stakeholders and government agency partners. All of those people are critical to achieving the type of impact that you want. And so when you go into conversation and engagement with them, that humility needs to show through, is that you don't come in as the one with the silver bullet solution. Nobody has the silver bullet solution. So that's what I mean by humility. And then, of course, when it comes time to taking or receiving recognition, it's being very generous about it, that it's not get recognition at all costs, no matter what, but rather maybe there are some instances where getting the recognition is useful for the impact of the work and other times it's not. And I'll give you an example where since I mentioned Habitat for Humanity Egypt already, at the celebration to celebrate 6,000 houses built within a very short period of time, about 6 years that they were able to build 6,000 houses, which was unprecedented scale up in Egypt or in Habitat globally. They had a big celebration. There were all these dignitaries gathered. There were homeowners, community members, government leaders, international funders gathered. And the national director, Yusri Makar, was invited to take the stage and say a few words about this great accomplishment. And he came up and took the stage and he said, "This isn't Habitat. We are merely providing support." And he invited all of his partners from the community to join him on stage. And again, this would have been a great PR fundraising opportunity for him to be able to get more resources into Habitat's door, into Habitat's organization. But he knew in order to address the poverty housing problem in Egypt, which was 20 million plus people living in primitive, high poverty housing, he knew he had to enable all of the boats to rise, that he needed all of these other partners to get recognition so the resources would flow to them as well, not just Habitat. And so that type of behavior happens again and again in these networks. And at the same time, there are other examples where Energy Foundation is one example where Eric Heitz, the president at the time when I wrote a case study, he said this concept of humility, not brand. He said, when there are outward facing opportunities where his organization is an intermediary, it's a funding intermediary. So he doesn't necessarily deal with the general public when he was leading Energy Foundation. Then he lets his grantees and his nonprofit partners take all the credit because they're the ones who are outward facing and need to fundraise. But he said, at the same time, when I'm working with my donors, I'll self-promote like crazy and I'll tell them all the great things that we did. But it's being very selective about when does it make sense to take the limelight and use it for the mission purpose. And other times it makes sense to take a step back and let your peers and partners who are in a better position to lead to take that. So it's being a little bit wiser about how we use those opportunities rather than self-promote at all costs.
Yeah. And so the North Star is actually something that you said at the very beginning, which is keeping in mind what is the impact you want to achieve and keeping in mind that you will best be able to achieve it by leveraging an ecosystem of partners and not just by yourself. And that is what underlies your mission over organization, your humility over brand. So it's always this idea of, I'm not just thinking of myself. I'm thinking of the entire ecosystem of people and organizations that together can enable this impact. And this is what I want to maximize.
Yes. As you pointed out, these principles are all very closely intertwined. So it's hard to pull them all apart. And the constellations, not stars, just reaffirms so many of the things that we've already been talking about in our conversation, where it really is putting the mission at the center and then thinking about, well, it's not about being the market leader or the dominant player, but really how I can build that larger system to get to that scale of impact and that sustainability of impact and that greater effectiveness. So it really is a shift in thinking where there's no single answer and there's no single path, but these things are very dynamic. They're going to change. Different partners will work together at different times in different communities. And even over time, they may change and need to adjust. But the whole idea is that the mechanism for change is going to be the system, not the individual or the institution on its own. And so that allows us first to be more ambitious because we can take on bigger challenges when we know it doesn't depend just on us and the resources that we control, but can actually draw on a whole system of talent and resources and capacities. And then at the same time, we can have more fun doing it. We can work with peers and partners. It's kind of one of the reasons why human beings love sports and teamwork so much, because there is this joy and a reward that you get from accomplishing something that goes beyond yourself. That's a bigger goal that you only could have done with a number of teammates or partners. And that's how essentially humans have been functioning in civilization for all time. And that's maybe what makes what we're talking about so basic is these are fundamental things that we human beings have always done, that we're wired to want to do. We're social beings. We're social creatures that we seek that connection and that interaction. In fact, that's probably why solitary confinement is a form of torture for mm-hmm. humans, right? That because we need each other. And so the more we can bring that into our professional lives in service of the mission, the better off we're all going to be. And I think we've somehow drifted away from that over time. And I'm just trying to, among many others, bring us back to the basics of what matters. And it's human connection, relationships, dare I say, love. And that's what we all really want in our lives.
And Jane, this brings us to another very interesting part of our conversation. The reason why I was so excited to have you on the podcast is you are an evangelizer in the best sense of the word. You're pushing these ideas because you are convinced that you know that they're the most effective way of realizing impact in the world. And as you've made clear at the beginning and through the conversation, impact, especially in areas where impact is hugely important for humanity. You made the example of, you know, building housing, nonprofits work in areas that are aimed at improving social conditions, alleviating suffering. So these are lessons that are very powerful for any industry, but you are in it because you want to see the impact. Now, as you highlighted in your last comment, these are the principles you are pushing are principles that, first of all, are almost instinctively embedded in our nature, as you've pointed out, because we are social animals. On top of that, today, even in the business conversation has shifted. Everybody says, yes, networks are important. Yes, it's all about ecosystems. Yes, collaboration is fundamental. But you've also expressed some frustration that a lot of people talk the talk, but the behaviors are a lot harder to change. Is that the case?
Yes, that's true. Because I'll admit, I've been doing this work now for 25 years. And I'll also be the first to admit, I don't pretend to have invented this framework or this approach. This has been happening, again, through leadership for all time. And people have been doing this on their own. They did not learn it from me. They actually came to it on their own, intuitively, in many cases, where leaders saw a big challenge and they saw they had limited resources. And to them, the most logical way was to work in community with others in order to address that big challenge. So that is one thing I always like to emphasize, is these principles come from studying successful, thriving networks that were getting great things done. And then I just happened to distill the lessons that were emerging and this pattern that was coming across all of these disparate examples in different fields from different types of organizations, different scale of organizations. So that's one thing, is to emphasize that this is not something that's new. The other is, I've lost my train of thought as far as the question. It was.
Oh, no. Your train of thought is always spectacularly smooth. We're talking about how there is a resistance to actually changing the behavior, right? People say, yes, it makes perfect sense, but then the behavior doesn't change.
Okay. Thank you. So the fact that it already exists all around us, maybe not in the most frequent or most abundant ways, that network leaders, networks themselves are all around, but we are not always good at looking for them and finding and supporting them. So that's one thing I think is a way to overcome the challenge of just changing our language and just window dressing. The way to really foster this way of working and make it come alive is to first find where it already is in our communities, in our organizations, and then see where and how can we support it. So it's not necessarily throwing away everything that's happening or what we're doing in our organizations and starting from scratch. It's just reverse engineering it and saying, well, where are there already successes of people and leaders who have created these types of collaboratives that demonstrate these values, and go ask them, What else do you need support on? What could you use some help on? Where are there gaps? And playing that support role rather than dictating, this is how the things should be. Now everybody needs to partner. Everybody needs to network. Here's the new template that everybody has to follow in order to do this. It's not something that can be mandated from the top down. It really is connecting people human to human, sometimes 2, 3, 4, small scale. But as you begin to get success, more people are going to be attracted to be part of that. And then it can grow. And if you have all sorts of people doing that in their roles, this isn't something that can just be delegated to a collaboration officer or a network czar. It really is part of the culture of the organization. It needs to be fully baked into the incentive structures, the types of leaders who are recruited and promoted, that all the leaders need to demonstrate a fidelity to this way of leading, and then lifting up those examples when they exist in the organization and supporting them. Because so often we get so focused on the linear and how we do things and dictating the systems and the structures and then the accountability systems, but we don't allow for this organic dynamism and the connection that's going to happen among people. And sometimes people will find someone they really trust and they like working with, and they'll want to keep doing things together with them, but there isn't a support or an opportunity to do that. And others, maybe they're forced to work with somebody and there's not that energy or connection, because let's face it, there are certain personalities that we're drawn to, and it's okay to have that selectivity where you find the people that you really get energized by and then build work and opportunities and address challenges together. But I think allowing for that organic emergence rather than trying to dictate is what's maybe challenging for organizations, because once organizations see, oh, this is the way we should be working, then they try to mandate it and push it through the system. But I always say there are people in every community that I've had the chance to go visit and speak with and engage with and lead workshops with. Every time in a big conference room and a small conference room, the people often with whom this work resonates most with, they come talk to me afterward and they'll say, oh, I just loved your talk. I've been working this way my whole career. And now I have a language and a framework to articulate what it is that I've been doing. And people won't think I'm crazy or they won't think I'm stupid anymore because I didn't know there was an academic studying this. And so that's really rewarding for me, because that's who inspired me to do the work, is that I saw so many great leaders that weren't trying to be heroic or trying to get all this attention. They were really doing the work because they believed in it and want to get to that impact. And yet it was such a big struggle that they couldn't attract the resources. They couldn't get their boards to support them, or even their own teams couldn't understand. And so I wanted to do work that could help clear the path and make it easier for them to do the work that I have seen works. And again, we both have said, this seems so common sense. If you're trying to do big projects and challenging, complex organizations, that of course you need collaboration, but we sometimes take it for granted that collaboration is simply productive interactions amongst individuals, human beings. And of course, then relationships matter, and they matter a lot. So
it's another great insight, Jane, because essentially what you're saying is, because it is something that is to some extent instinctive in all of us, don't try to mandate it. Find where it already occurs naturally and try to amplify, try to showcase it, and set essentially the right incentives. And sometimes just tweaks to the incentives, to the way the organization functions, are what works. It reminds me of something that struck me when I started working at GE, because I found that it was a tremendously competitive environment internally. But I had just entered the organization from the outside. Whenever I needed something, if I reached out to somebody whom I didn't know, they didn't know me, they all responded. They always helped. And I was shocked. I said, why? It's great, but why are they doing it? And I realized it was for two reasons. One is that there was a setup where people were encouraged to switch around, switch positions, switch sectors within the organizations, which meant that if you called me asking for something, in the back of my mind, I knew that you and I might be working together next month in the same team. Yeah. And secondly, that whether or not you had a reputation for being a team player was recognized and played a huge role in the incentive system. So it's a very, very insightful point that you've made on how to make this happen. Jane, this is a spectacular collection of insights on how to do things differently for greatest impact. I love the way you've highlighted that you have these four principles which are framed in a provocative way that catches the attention, people listen, and they really remain in your mind. But what you're pointing out is really the trade-off and the combination of different aspects like trust and control, like mission organization. Is there anything that we have not, well, there is a lot that we have not covered, as inevitably we'll have to have you back on, but anything that you would like to add to our conversation before we wrap it up? Anything that you think our audience should definitely take away from our conversation?
Yes, thank you. I think one of the key things is that it's not that hard, that this is a simple concept. And I deliberately tried to make the framework very simple because, frankly, I don't like things so complicated that people get confused and they don't understand. And I never found that to be useful in all my time in academia, to use so much jargon and theory that people get confused. So it's simple. At the same time, it may seem daunting, but it's very actionable, that we can show up in the next meeting that you go to, in the next conversation that you have, and maybe let a lot of the trappings of success or status and power fall away and just show up and be your real authentic self. Find a way to connect with the person that you're talking to and show that you care, and bring as much heart as you do head into your work, that it can amplify and enable you to do even more than you could have ever imagined. And I truly have faith that that is possible, because that's what I've tried to do. I try to emulate a lot of the network leaders I've learned from. And I'm always seeking to connect with others who believe in this way of working, to say, how can we change the world together? How can we promote this way of leading in the world? Because I think it will make the world truly a kinder, gentler place and a better place for all of us. So I hope everybody will try it. And if they already are working in this way, because I know many people are, I encourage you to just keep doing what you're doing, even if the forces that be may sometimes make you doubt yourself and make you wonder if you're on the right path. You are absolutely on the right path, and I commend you for doing the work that you're doing.
That's a beautiful note to end on. Just one last thing. Where can people go to find out more about your ideas and what you're doing?
Yes, thank you. So I have a pretty homegrown website that I put together with some trusted colleagues of mine to promote this way of working. I'm not selling anything on it. It just has research articles, all my articles, case studies. There's some podcasts and some videos that are just there and available. It's called newnetworker.org. And I created that on the heels of a blog series that I had written for Stanford Social Innovation Review, a journal in the nonprofit space. And there was a great reception to that blog series, and then created this website to help spread a lot of the ideas in that. So feel free to reach out. Also, I'm on LinkedIn. I always love to hear from people who are interested in or already working in this way, because as Marco said, I am a network evangelizer. I want to champion people who work this way already or support people along their journeys to work and lead in this way, because I truly believe this is what the world needs, and it's the only way we're going to get to transformational change. So newnetworkleader.org.
Fantastic. And the web address will be in the show notes so the audience can find it and click on it. Janeway Skillen, thank you so much for being with us. It was a fantastic conversation, lots of great insights. Thank you so much for being with us, and keep going. Keep doing it.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity, and truly has been a pleasure.
And thanks to all our listeners today. You will find in the show notes where to find more about Jane's work. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Stay tuned for the next ones. Subscribe on Spotify or wherever else you get your podcast diet, and visit shoshinworks.com for more. Thanks, everybody.